seemed Clef did not know his own potential. And that was troubling, since Clef already seemed stupefyingly powerful. Because though few understood how scrying worked, everyone in the world understood that it was both powerful and reliable. When merchant house ships scryved to part the waters with incredible ease, and sporting altered sails that always billowed with the perfect breeze at the perfect angle, pulled up in front of your city and pointed their vast, scribed weaponry at you, you understood that all those weapons would work perfectly well, and you'd promptly surrender. The alternative, the idea that those ships might malfunction or fail, was inconceivable. But it wasn't anymore. Not to Sanchia, clutching Clef in her hand. Scrying formed the foundation of the Tavani Empire. It had won countless cities, built up an army of slaves, and sent them to work in the plantation isles. But now, in Sanchia's mind, that foundation was beginning to shift and crack. Then her skin went cold. If I were a merchant house, she thought to herself, I'd do everything in my power to destroy Clef and make sure no one ever, ever knew he'd existed.
So, said Clef cheerily, what now?
She was wondering that herself. I need to make sure all this means what I think it means.
And what do you think this means?
Well, I think it means that you and I, and probably Sark, are in a shitload of mortal peril, Clef.
Ah. Oh. And, how can we confirm that?
She rubbed her mouth. Then she stood up, hung Clef back around her neck, and started off. I'm taking you to see some friends of mine. Ones who know a lot scrumming more about scrying than I do.
Chapter 6 Sanchia slipped down alleys and passageways and crossed the carriage fairways of Foundryside until she came to the next commons neighborhood, Old Ditch. Foundryside might have been unpleasant to live in because of the residents. The neighborhood was notorious for its dense concentration of criminals, but Old Ditch was unpleasant due to its environment. Since it was situated next to the Tavani tanneries, the whole area smelled like death and rot. Sanchia did not mind such odors, however, and she wandered down a meandering alley, peering through the staggered rookeries and wooden shacks. The alley ended in a small, bland door, but hanging above it were four lit-colored lanterns, three red, one blue. Not here, she thought. She returned to the main street, then walked around a block until she came to a basement door. Four lanterns hung outside. Again, three red, one blue. Not here either. She walked back to the main thoroughfare.
Are you lost? Asked Clef.
No, she said. The people I want to see, they're kind of mobile.
What, like gypsies or something?
In a way. They move around a lot to avoid raids.
Raids from who?
The campos. The merchant houses. She peered through a leaning iron fence at a crumbling stone courtyard. At the very back was a long stairwell down, and hanging above it were four lanterns. Yet, unlike the others, these were three blue, one red. Here we are. Sanchia hopped the fence and crossed the courtyard. She walked down the dark stairwell to a thick wooden door and knocked three times. A slot in the door opened. A pair of eyes peered out, narrowed in suspicion. Then they saw Sanchia and crinkled into a smile.
Back so soon?
Said a woman's voice.
Not by choice, said Sanchia.
The door fell open and Sanchia walked in. Instantly, the murmuring of hundreds of scribed objects filled up her ears.
Ah, said Clef. The merchant houses don't like your friends having quite so many toys.
Exactly. The basement within was long, low, and strangely lit.
Most of the luminescence came from the 10 or so scribed glass lights that had been carelessly laid down on the stone floor. The corners were stuffed with books and piles of paper, all of them covered with instructions and diagrams. In between the lights were rolling carts that would, to the untrained eye, appear to be covered with rubbish. Ingots of metals, loops of leather bands, strips of wood, and so on. The room was also incredibly hot, thanks to the large scribed bowls at the back that heated copper and bronze and other metals into a broiling liquid, though someone had set up a fan to circulate the hot air out, cleverly powered, Sanchia saw, by stolen carriage wheels which ran and ran in place, operating the fans. About a half dozen people sat around the bowls of molten metals, plucking at the metals with long, stylus-like tools, which they then used to paint symbols on, well, all kinds of things. Small bronze balls, wooden boards, shoes, shirt collars, carriage wheels, hammers, knives, anything and everything. The door shut behind Sanchia, revealing a tall, thin, dark-skinned woman with a pair of magnifying goggles on top of her head. "If you're looking for a custom job, San, you'll have to wait," she said. "We've got a rush order." "What's happening?" asked Sanchia. "The Candianos are mixing up their sachet procedures," said the woman. "Totally redoing everything. So a lot of our clients are desperate." "When are your clients ever not desperate?" asked Sanchia. She smiled. Claudia was always smiling a little. This mystified Sanchia, since in her own estimation, Claudia didn't have much to smile about. Scribing in such circumstances, hot, dark, and cramped, was not only uncomfortable, but also incredibly dangerous. Claudia's fingers and forearms, for instance, were spotted with shiny, bubbly burn scars. But that was what the scrappers had to do. To do their work in open environs would be to invite violence, if not death. Scribing was a difficult practice, painting dozens and hundreds of sigillums upon objects, all carefully forming commands and logic that would reshape that object's reality, required not only years of study, but also a mind both calculating and creative. Lots of scribers failed to secure employment at a merchant house campo, and many others washed out. And there had been recent changes in the scribing culture that had made it suddenly quite difficult for a woman to find employment on the campos. Most merchant house applicants who didn't make it went to other Tavani fealty states to do undignified, dull work out in the backwaters. But not all. Some moved to the Tavani Commons and went independent, forging, adjusting, and stealing the designs of the four prime merchant houses. This wasn't easy, but everyone had their contacts. Some were corrupt campo officials who could pass along the right designs and strings. Others were thieves like Sanchia, who could steal merchant house instructions on how to make a sigil just right. But bit by bit, people had begun to share knowledge, until a small, nebulous group of dilettantes, ex-campo employees, and frustrated scribers had built up a library of information in the commons, and trade had flourished. That was how the scrappers got started. If you needed a lock fixed, or a door reinforced, or a blade altered, or if you just wanted light or clean water, the scrappers would sell you rigs that could do that, for a fee, of course. And that fee was usually pretty high, but it was the only way for a commoner to get the tools and creature comforts reserved for the campos, though the quality was never totally reliable. This was not illegal, as there were no laws in the commons, it couldn't be. But it was also not illegal for the merchant houses to organize raids to kick down your door, destroy everything you'd made, and also maybe break your fingers or your face in the process. So you had to stay quiet, stay underground, and keep moving. "Not bad stuff," Clef said in Sanchia's ear as they walked through the messy workshop. "Some of it's trash, but
some of it's pretty ingenious. Like the carriage wheels. They've figured out all kinds of uses for those.
The foundries did that first, said Sanchia. Apparently, that was where they first experimented with gravity, just so they could get all their machines to move around and work better.
Clever stuff.
Kind of. I hear it didn't go totally flawlessly at the start, and a few scrivers accidentally quintupled their gravity or something.
Meaning?
Meaning they got crushed into a vaguely flesh-like object about as thick as an iron pan.
Okay, maybe not so clever.
Claudia led Sanchia to the back of the room, where Giovanni, a veteran scrapper, was seated before a small desk and was carefully painting sigils onto a wooden button. He glanced up from his work ever so briefly.
Evening, son.
He smiled at her, his graying beard crinkling. He'd been a venerated scriver before he'd washed out of Morsini House, and the other scrappers tended to defer to him.
How'd the goods hold up? You seem all in one piece.
Somewhat.
Somewhat what?
Sanchia walked around and, with an air of quaint civility, moved his desk aside. Then she sat down in front of him and smiled into his face, her muddy eye squinting unpleasantly. They somewhat worked, right up until your goddamn sailing rig nearly fell apart and dumped me over the waterfront bridge.
It what?
Yeah. If it were anyone else, Gio, anyone else, I'd gut you stern to crotch for what happened out there.
Giovanni blinked, then smiled. Discount next time? 20%?
50.
25.
50.
30?
50.
All right, 50 it is.
Good, said Sanchia. Get stronger material for the parachute next time, and you overdid it on the flashbox. Giovanni's eyebrows rose.
Oh, so that's what caused the waterfront fire?
Too much magnesium in the box, said Claudia.
She tisked.
I told you so, Gio.
Duly noted,
he said.
And my apologies, dear Sanchia. I shall correct the formulas accordingly for future rigs.
He moved his desk back and returned to the wooden button. Sanchia watched. So what's going on? Your customers need new sachets that quick? Yes, said Claudia.
Apparently the Candiano Campo is an unusually promiscuous one.
Promiscuous.
Yes, there is, how shall I say, a strong appetite there for discreet arrangements.
Ah, said Sanchia, understanding. Night ladies, then.
And men,
added Giovanni.
Yes, said Claudia. Them, too.
This was well-trodden ground for Sanchia. Merchant house walls were scribed so that the entrances only allowed in people with specific identifying markers called sachets, wooden buttons with scribed permissions on them. If you walked through the wrong door with the wrong sachet or no sachet at all, you'd get accosted by guards or even killed by them. Or in some of the inner walls of the campos, where the richest, most protected people lived. Rumor had it, you could spontaneously explode. As someone who frequently needed illegitimate access to the campos, Sanchia usually had to go to the scrappers for forged sachets. But their biggest customers were undoubtedly prostitutes, who just wanted to go where the money was. Though the scrappers could usually only get you past the first wall or two. It was a lot harder to steal or forge the more elite credentials.
Why'd the Candianos change up their sachets? She asked. Did someone spook them?
No idea, said Claudia.
Rumor has it, mad old Tribuno Candiano is finally about to pull up the eternal blanket and begin his final sleep.
Giovanni clucked his tongue.
The conqueror himself, about to be conquered by old age. How tragic.
Maybe it's that, said Claudia. Elite deaths often cause some campo shuffling. If so, with everything in flux, there is probably a lot of easy targets on the Candiano Campo. If you were willing to take a side job, we'd pay.
Not market rates, said Giovanni pointedly. But we'd pay.
Not this time, Sanchia said. I've got some pressing matters. I need you to look at something.
Like I said, Claudia told her, we've got a rush job here.
I don't need you to copy the scrivings, said Sanchia, and I'm not sure you can. I just need advice.
Claudia and Giovanni exchanged a glance.
What do you mean we can't copy the scrivings? Asked Claudia.
And since when do you ever ask for advice?
Asked Giovanni.
Ah, said Clef in her ear. So, this is when I make my grand entrance?
Neat, said Claudia.
She peered at Clef over the scribed lights, her pale eyes huge and enlarged by her magnifying goggles, but also very weird. Giovanni looked over her shoulder.
I've never seen anything like it. Never in all my days.
Claudia glanced sideways at Sanchia.
You say it talks to you?
Yeah, said Sanchia.
And it's not your...
She tapped the side of her head.
I think that's why I can hear him. When I'm touching him, that is, said Sanchia.
Besides Sark, Claudia and Giovanni were the only people who knew that Sanchia was a scribed human. They'd had to know since they were the ones who'd put her in touch with the black market Physicares. But she trusted them. Mostly because the scrappers were just as hated and hunted by the merchant houses as she herself would be, if they ever found out what she was. If the scrappers gave her up, she could give them up in turn.
What does it say?
Asked Giovanni. Mostly he asks what all of our swears mean. Have you ever heard of anything like this?
I've seen scribed keys before, said Claudia. I tinkered with a few myself. Yet these etchings, these sigils, they're totally unfamiliar to me.
She looked up at Giovanni.
Siv?
Giovanni nodded.
Siv.
Huh? Said Sanchia.
She watched as Giovanni unrolled what appeared to be a largish sheet of leather. She saw it had buttons sewn into the corners, brass ones with faint, complicated sigils on their faces. He picked up Clef as if the key were a small, dying bird, and gently placed him in the center of the leather.
Whatever this isn't going to hurt him, is it? Asked Sanchia.
Giovanni blinked at her through his spectacles.
Him? You're suddenly sounding very attached to this object, San.
That object is worth a whole harpering heap of money, she said, feeling suddenly defensive about Clef.
One of Sark's jobs?
Asked Giovanni. Sanchia said nothing.
Stoic little San, he said.
He began slowly folding up the leather around Clef.
Our grim, tiny specter of the night. One day I will get a smile out of you.
What is this thing? Sanchia asked.
A scribing sieve, said Claudia. Place the object within it, and it'll identify some, but usually not all, of the major sigils being used to shape the object's nature.
Why not all? Said Sanchia.
Giovanni laughed as he placed a thick plate of iron on top of the wrapped-up leather.
One of these days, son, I will teach you something about the tiers of scribing. It's not one language, so it's not like you can just translate each sigillum individually. Rather, each sigil is its own command, which calls up a whole string of other sigils on the nearby lexicon.
Yeah, I didn't ask you to give me a degree in this stuff, said Sanchia.
Giovanni paused, miffed.
One might imagine, Sanchia, that you'd show more interest in the languages that power everything around you.
One also might imagine my ass getting to bed at a reasonable time. Grumbling, Giovanni grabbed a pinch of iron filings from a small cup and sprinkled them over the face of the plate.
Now let's see what we've got.
They sat there, watching and watching. Nothing seemed to be happening. Did you do it right? Asked Sanchia.
Of course I damned well did it right, snapped Giovanni.
So what should we be seeing? Asked Sanchia.
The filings should be rearranging themselves into the shapes of the primary commands being used in the object, said Claudia.
But if we are to believe this, it'd imply there are none.
Which, unless I'm mistaken, said Giovanni, is impossible.
Giovanni and Claudia looked at the iron plate for a while before turning to stare at each other, bewildered.
So, right, said Claudia.
She cleared her throat, then knelt and began wiping the plate clean.
So, it seems like there are, somehow, no sigils or commands on Clef that our methods can identify, like none.
Meaning what? Asked Sanchia.
Meaning we don't know what the hell it or he or whatever really is,
said Giovanni.
His sigils are talking a language we don't know, in other words.
Would a merchant house be interested in this? Said Sanchia.
Oh, holy monkeys, yes, said Claudia. If there's a whole new scribing language out there, and they get a hold of it, they...
She trailed off. Then she looked at Giovanni, troubled.
What?
Said Sanchia.
I was thinking the same thing,
said Giovanni to her quietly.
What? Said Sanchia.
Thinking what?
The two of them sat in silence, staring at each other and occasionally glancing at Sanchia.
Thinking what? She demanded.
Claudia glanced nervously around the workshop.
Let's take this somewhere private.
Sanchia followed Claudia and Giovanni into the back office, stuffing Clef back down her jerkin as she did so. The back office was filled with tomes and books of sigil strings and scribing commands, reams and reams and reams of papers covered in symbols that made no sense to Sanchia. She watched as Claudia shut the door behind them and locked it.
That doesn't seem good, said Clef.
No. No, it doesn't. Giovanni pulled out a bottle of a potent, noxious cane wine, poured three glasses, and picked up two.
Drink,
he said, extending one to Sanchia. No.
Sure?
Yes, she said testily.
You never have fun, son. You deserve some. Especially now.
Fun is a luxury. What I deserve is to know how big of a pot of shit I'm in.
How long have you lived in Tavon now?
Asked Giovanni. A bit over 3 years. Why?
Well.
Giovanni tossed one glass back, then the other.
This will take some explaining, then.
Claudia took a seat behind a stack of tomes.
Ever heard of the Occidentals, Sanchia?
She asked quietly. Yeah, said Sanchia. The fairy giants. They built the ruins across the Durazzo in the Daolo countries. Aqueducts and the like, right?
Kind of, said Giovanni. To put it plainly, they were the people who invented scribing long, long, long ago. Though no one's even sure if they really were people. Some say they were angels, or something a lot like angels. They were also called hierophants, and in most of the old stories, they're regarded as priests or monks or prophets. The first of them, the most notable of them,
was Chrysides the Great. They weren't giants, though. They just used their scrying to do some very, very big things.
Like what? Asked Sanchia.
Like move mountains, said Claudia. Carve out oceans and annihilate cities and build a massive, massive empire.
Really? Said Sanchia.
Yes, said Giovanni. One that makes the merchant house empire we've got today look like a piddling pile of shit.
This was a long time ago, mind, said Claudia. 1,000 years or so.
What happened to this empire? She asked.
It all fell apart, said Claudia. Nobody knows how or why. But when it fell hard. Almost nothing survived. No one even knows the real name of the empire. We just call it the Occidental Empire because it was to the west. Like everything to the west. The Hierophants owned all of it.
Supposedly, Tavan was just a backwater jungle port for this empire, ages and ages and ages ago, said Giovanni, pouring himself another drink.
Claudia frowned at him.
You've got work tonight, Gio.
He sniffed.
Makes my hands steadier.
That's not what the Morsinis said when they tossed you out on your ass.
They misunderstood the nature of my genius, he said airily.
He slurped down cane wine. Claudia rolled her eyes.
Anyways, apparently Tavan was far-flung enough that when the Occidental Empire collapsed and all the Hierophants died out, it escaped the damage.
And it just stuck around, said Claudia. Until about 80 years ago, when some Tavani found a hidden cache of Occidental records in the cliffs east of here, detailing in vague terms the art of scrying.
And that, said Giovanni with a theatrical flourish, is how the Tavan of today was born.
There was a moment of silence as this sank in.
Wait, what? Said Sanchia. Really? You're saying that what the merchant houses do today is based on some notes from some ancient dead civilization?
Not even good notes, said Giovanni. Boggles the mind, doesn't it?
It boggles a whole hell of a lot more than that, said Claudia. Because the merchant houses today can do a lot of stuff with scrying. But they don't hold a scrumming candle to what the Hierophants could do, like fly or make things float.
Or walk on water, said Giovanni.
Make a door in the sky, said Claudia.
Chrysides the Great would point his magic wand,
Giovanni mimed the action.
And poof, the seas themselves would part.
They say Chrysides even kept a genie in a basket at his waist, said Claudia. He'd open it up and let it out, and it'd build a castle for him, or tear down walls, or... You get the idea.
Suddenly, Sanchia recalled a passage from the note she'd found in the box with Clef. If Chrysides was in possession of some kind of invisible entity, perhaps it was but a rough prototype for this last and greatest iteration.
No one knows how the Hierophants did what they did, said Claudia. But the merchant houses are desperately, desperately searching for ways to figure it out.
To graduate from making scribed toilets, said Giovanni, to making tools and devices that can, say, smash mountains or drain the sea, maybe.
No one's gotten close. Until recently.
What's happened recently? Asked Sanchia.
About 1 year ago, a band of pirates stumbled across a tiny island in the western Durazzo, said Giovanni, and found it covered with Occidental ruins.
The nearby town of Vialto went absolutely barking mad with treasure hunters, said Claudia.
Agents of the merchant houses, said Giovanni, or anyone who wanted to be a merchant house.
Because if you can find more records, more notes, said Claudia.
Or better yet, a real whole functional occidental tool, said Giovanni.
Well then, said Claudia quietly, you'd change the future of scribing forever. You'd make the merchant houses themselves obsolete.
You'd make our whole damn civilization obsolete, said Giovanni.
Sanchia felt nauseous. She suddenly remembered Clef saying,
There's nothing before the dark. There's just the dark. I was always in the dark as far as I can recall.
And it would, after all, be very dark in an ancient ruin.
And, she said slowly, and you think Clef...
I think Clef doesn't use any language that the houses use, said Claudia. And if what you say is true, he can do some pretty amazing things. And I think if you nabbed him from the waterfront, which would be, of course, where people would ship in anything from Vialto, she trailed off.
Then you might be walking around with a million Duvat key hanging from your neck, said Giovanni. Feel heavy?
Sanchia stood there, totally still. Clef, she said, is any of this true? But Clef was silent. They said nothing for a while. Then there was a knock at the door. Another scrapper asking for Giovanni's assistance. He apologized and departed, leaving Claudia and Sanchia alone in the back office.
You seem to be dealing with this well, said Claudia.
Sanchia said nothing. She'd barely moved.
Most people,
they would have had an absolute nervous breakdown if...
I don't have time for nervous breakdowns, said Sanchia, quietly and coldly. She looked away, rubbing the side of her head.
Damn it! I was going to get this payout and then get yourself fixed.
Yeah, but I don't see that happening now. Claudia absently fingered a scar on her forearm.
Do I need to say that you shouldn't have taken the job?
Sanchia glared at her. Claudia, not now.
I warned you about merchant housework. I told you they'd scrum you in the end.
Enough.
But you kept doing it.
Sanchia went silent.
Why don't you hate them? Said Claudia, frustrated. Why don't you despise them for what they did to you?
There was a brittle fury in her eyes. Claudia was an immensely talented scriver, but after the house academies had stopped accepting women, all her prospects had vanished. She'd been forced to join the scrappers and spend her days working in dank basements and abandoned lofts. Despite her cheerful demeanor, she'd never been able to forgive the merchant houses for that.
Grudges, said Sanchia, are a privilege I can't afford.
Claudia sank back in her chair and scoffed.
Sometimes I admire how you can be so bloodlessly practical, Sanchia, she said. But then, I remember that it doesn't look very pleasant.
Sanchia said nothing.
Does Sark know? Asked Claudia.
She shook her head.
Don't think so. What are you going to do?
Tell Sark when I go to debrief with him in 2 days. Then we skip town, grab the first boat out of here, and go somewhere far, far away.
Really?
Sanchia nodded. I don't see another way around it. Not if Clef is what you say he is.
And you're taking him with you?
I'm not leaving him behind. I'm not going to be the asshole who lets the merchant houses assume godlike powers out of sheer scrumming negligence.
You can't get to Sark earlier?
I know one of his apartments, but Sark's even more paranoid than I am. Getting tortured has that effect on you. He vanishes after I've done a job for him. Even I don't know where he goes.
Well, not to make your options any more complicated, but leaving Tavan might not be quite as easy as you think.
Sanchia raised an eyebrow.
There's all the stuff with Clef, said Claudia. That's one thing. But there's also the fact that you burned down the waterfront, Sanchia, or at least a lot of it. I have no doubt that some powerful people are looking for you right now. And if they find out who you are, no ship's captain in Tavan is going to take you anywhere. Not for all the cane, wine, and roses on this earth.
Chapter 7 Captain Gregor Dandolo of the Tavani Water Watch held his head high as he walked through the throngs of Foundryside. He did not really know another way to walk. His posture was, at all times, absolutely pristine, back arched and shoulders thrown back. Between this, his large size, and his water watch sash, everyone in the commons tended to get out of his way. They didn't know what he was here for, but they wanted no part of it. Gregor knew it was odd to feel so jaunty. He was a thoroughly disgraced man, having allowed nearly half the waterfront to burn down under his watch. And he was now facing suspension from the water watch, if not outright expulsion. Yet, this was a situation that Gregor was quite comfortable with. A wrong had been done, and he intended to set it right, as quickly and as efficiently as possible. A musty wine bar door opened on his right up ahead, and a soused woman with smeared face paint staggered out onto the creaky wooden walkway in front of him. He stopped, bowed, and extended an arm.
After you, ma'am.
The drunken woman stared at him like he was mad.
After what?
Ah, you, ma'am. After you.
Oh, I see.
She blinked drunkenly, but did not move. Gregor, realizing she had no idea what the phrase meant, sighed slightly.
You may walk ahead of me,
he said gently.
Oh, ho, ho, well then, thanks to you.
Certainly, ma'am.
Again, he bowed. She tottered ahead of him. Gregor walked up beside her, and the wooden walkway bent slightly under his sizable bulk, which made her stumble.
Pardon me,
he said, but I had a question. She looked him over.
I'm off duty, she said. At least till I find some place quiet to spew up a bit and dab my nose.
I see. But no, I wanted to ask, would the Taverna, the Perch, and Lark be somewhere nearby?
She gaped at him.
The Perch and Lark?
Indeed, ma'am.
You want to go there?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, sub that away.
She pointed down a filthy alley. He bowed once more.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Good evening to you.
Wait, she said. A fine man such as yourself won't want to go there. That place is a damn snake pit. Antonin's boys will chew you up and spit you out soon as look at you.
Thank you,
sang Gregor, and he strode off into the evening mist. It had been 3 days since the waterfront fiasco. 3 days since all of Gregor's efforts to make a decent, functional, law-abiding civilian police force, the first of its kind in Tavan, had quite literally gone up in smoke. There had been a lot of finger-pointing and accusations in that handful of days since, but only Gregor had had a mind to actually do some investigating. What he'd found was that his initial instincts on the night of the fiasco had been correct. There had been a bad actor on the premises. They had indeed targeted the safes of the Water Watch, and they'd even successfully stolen something. Specifically, a small bland box from safe 23D had gone missing. How they'd managed to do that,
Gregor couldn't imagine. Every safe was outfitted with a Miranda brass tumbler lock, and Gregor himself changed the combinations on a fixed schedule. They must have been a master safe-cracker to pull it off. But a theft and a fire on the same night? That was no coincidence. Whoever had done one had also done the other. Gregor had checked the Water Watch logs regarding the box, hoping that the owner might suggest the identity of the thief. But that had been a dead end. The owner's name had been submitted just as Berenice, nothing more, with no contact information included. He could find nothing more about this Berenice either. But he was well acquainted with the criminal element in Tavan. If he could find nothing about the box's owner, then he would start making headway on potential thieves. And this evening, here in the south end of Foundryside, he could get started. He stopped at one thoroughfare, squinting through the mist, which turned mottled colors from the lanterns hanging overhead. Then he saw his destination. The sign hanging above the taverna door read, "The Perch and Lark." He didn't really need to see the sign, however. The large, scarred, threatening-looking men loitering outside the door were enough to tell him he was in the right place. The Perch and Lark was base of operations for one of the most preeminent crime lords in Foundryside, if not all the commons. Antonin Genove. Gregor knew this because his own reforms at the waterfront had directly affected the economics of Antonin's ventures, which had displeased Antonin to the point that he'd sent some hired steel out after Gregor. Though Gregor had sent them back very quickly, with many broken fingers and one shattered jaw. He had no doubt that Antonin still harbored lots of bad feelings about this, which was why Gregor had brought 500 duvats of his own money and whip, his scribed truncheon. Hopefully, the duvats would entice Antonin into giving Gregor some information about what thief could have hit the waterfront. And hopefully, whip would keep Gregor alive long enough to ask. He marched up to the four glowering heavies before the taverna entrance. "Good evening, gentlemen," he said.
"I'd like to see Mr. Genove, please."
The heavies glanced at each other, somewhat baffled by Gregor's politeness. Then one, who was missing quite a lot of teeth, said,
"Not with that you aren't."
He nodded at Whip, which was hanging by Gregor's side.
"Certainly," he said.
He unbuckled Whip and held it out. One of them took it and tossed it into a box, where it had company with a simply staggering number of knives, rapiers, swords, and other grislier armaments.
"May I enter now, please?" asked Gregor.
50 duvats,
said the toothless heavy.
"I beg your pardon," said Gregor.
50? 50 if we haven't seen your face afore. And I don't know your face, sir."
"I see. Well."
Gregor glanced at their weapons. Spears, knives, and one even had an espringle, a sort of mechanized heavy crossbow that you had to crank, though its gears hadn't been set correctly. He made a note of it. Gregor always made a note of such things. He reached into his satchel, took out a handful of devots, and handed them over.
"Now, may I enter?"
The heavies exchanged another glance.
"What's your business with Antonin?" asked the toothless one.
"My business is both pressing and private," said Gregor.
The toothless guard grinned at him.
"Oh, very professional. We don't see too many professional types here, do we, chaps? Not unless they've come down here to scrum the night, lads, eh?"
The others laughed. Gregor waited calmly, meeting the man's gaze.
"Fair enough,"
said the toothless heavy. He opened the door.
"Back table, but move slow."
Gregor smiled curtly, said thank you, and walked inside. Immediately inside was a short flight of steps. He bounced up the steps, and as he did, the air got smokier, louder, and much, much more pungent. At the top of the steps was a blue drape, and he shoved it aside and walked into the taverna. Gregor glanced around. "Hmm," he said. As a former career soldier, Gregor was accustomed to tavernas, even ones as filthy as this. Reeking candles burned on all the tabletops. The floor was little more than a loose grid of wooden slats, so that if someone spilled anything, cane wine, grain alcohol, or any number of bodily fluids, it would drain right through to the mud below. Someone was playing a set of box pipes in the back, albeit very badly, and the music was loud enough to drown out most conversation. But then, people did not come to tavernas like this for conversation. They came to fill their skulls up with so much cane wine that they forgot for one brief moment that they lived in shit-spattered, muddy ditches, clinging to the clean white walls of the campos, that they shared their living quarters with animals, that they awoke every morning to fresh insect bites or shrieking monkeys, or the putrid scent of rotting striper shells in the alleys. If they awoke at all, that is. Gregor barely blinked at the sight. He had seen many horrors in war, and he did not count the sight of the impoverished among them. He himself had once been far more desperate than any of these people. He glanced through the crowd, looking for Antonin's men. He counted four straight away, taking up positions at the edges of the taverna. All of them had rapiers, except for the one in the far corner, who was huge and thick-set, and leaned against the wall with a threatening black axe strapped to his back. A Dowlo axe, Gregor saw. He'd seen many of their like in the Enlightenment Wars. He crossed the taverna, spied a table in the back, and approached, slowly. He could tell which one of them was Antonin right away, because the man's clothes were clean, his skin unblemished, his thin hair combed neatly back, and he was hugely, hugely fat, a rarity in the commons. He was also reading a book, something Gregor had never seen anyone do in such a place. Antonin had another guard sitting beside him, this one with two stilettos stuffed in his belt, and the guard tensed as Gregor neared. Antonin's brow furrowed slightly, and he looked up from his book. He glanced at Gregor's face, then his belt, which held no weapons, and then his sash.
"Water Watch," he remarked aloud. "What's Water Watch doing in a place where the only waters to watch are wine and piss?"
Then he peered closer at Gregor's face.
"Ah, I know you. It's Dandolo, isn't it?"
"You are a knowledgeable man, sir," said Gregor. He bowed slightly. "I am indeed Captain Gregor Dandolo of the Water Watch, Mr. Antonin."
"Mr. Antonin,"
he echoed. Antonin laughed, showing off black teeth.
"Such a well-mannered gent here among us. I'd have wiped myself better this morn if I'd known you deign to bless us with your presence. If I recall, I tried to have you killed once, didn't I?"
"You did."
"Ah, here to return the favor?"
The thick-set guard with the axe wandered over to take up a position behind Gregor.
"No, sir," said Gregor. "I've come to ask you a question."
"Huh."
His gaze lingered on Gregor's Water Watch sash.
"I will assume your question has something to do with your waterfront disaster."
Gregor smiled humorlessly.
"It would, sir."
"Yes, it would."
Antonin gestured to the seat across him with one pudgy finger.
"Please, do me the honor of sitting."
Gregor bowed lightly and did so.
"Now, why would you come to me to ask about that?"
said Antonin.
"I gave up the waterfront a long time ago. Thanks to you, of course."
His black eyes glittered.
"Because it was an independent," said Gregor. "And you know independence."
"What makes you so sure?"
"They used an improvised sailing rig.
They planted a construction scribing on one of the carriages, something used for adhesives and mortars. And this acted as a rudimentary arrangement to power their rig. It was shoddily made, and did not seem to work well.
Something no real canal operator would ever use, then.
Correct. A real one could get the real thing. So, an independent, and independents tend to live in one place, Foundry Side, or close to it, which is your domain, unless I'm mistaken.
Makes sense. Very clever. But the real question is, why would I help you?
He smiled.
Your water watch experiment seems to have failed. Wouldn't it be in my interests to make sure it stays that way and reclaim the waterfront?
It has not failed, said Gregor. That remains to be seen.
I don't need to see,
said Antonin with a laugh.
So long as the merchant houses run their campos like kings, Tavon won't ever have anything resembling a policing system. No matter how excellent you make the water watch. And that will fail, too, in time. So, my noble captain, I really just need to wait. And then I'll find my way back in, won't I?
Gregor blinked slowly, but did not react. Though Antonin was now needling a sensitive wound of his. He had done a lot of work to build up the water watch, and he did not appreciate hearing it threatened.
I can pay, he said.
Antonin smirked.
How much?
450 devats.
Antonin glanced at his satchel.
Which I assume you've brought yourself, because I wouldn't believe you'd pay if you hadn't.
Yes.
So what's keeping me from putting some steel in your ribs and taking it now?
Asked Antonin.
My last name, said Gregor.
Antonin sighed.
Ah, yes. Were we to expire the sole progeny of Ophelia Dandolo, I've no doubt that all hell would come down on us.
Yes.
Gregor tried to swallow his self-disgust. His mother was a direct descendant of the founder of Dandolo Chartered, which made them something akin to royalty in Tavon. But he thoroughly disdained leveraging his family's reputation for his own ends.
And I would not give up the money easily. You would have to kill me, Antonin.
Yes, yes, the good soldier,
said Antonin.
But not the best strategist.
He smiled wickedly.
You were at the siege of Dantua, weren't you, Captain?
Gregor was silent.
You were,
said Antonin.
I know. They call you the Revenant of Dantua. Have you heard that?
Again, he said nothing.
And I'm told they called you that,
said Antonin.
Because you died there. Or came damn close. They even had a memorial service here in the city for you. Thought you were rotting in a mass grave somewhere in the north.
I've heard the same, said Gregor.
They were wrong. So I see. I get a lot of veterans working for me, you know,
said Antonin.
And they tell me so many stories.
He leaned closer.
They told me that when your cohorts were holed up in Dantua, with all your scribed armaments ruined, why, they say you resorted to eating rats and garbage, and worse things besides.
He grinned wide.
Tell me, Captain Dandolo, how does Tavani Long Pig taste?
There was a long silence.
I would not know, said Gregor calmly. What does this have to do with my proposal?
I suppose I'm just a filthy gossip,
said Antonin.
Or maybe I like telling you, you're not as righteous as you act. You killed my prophet from the waterfront, brave Captain Dan Dolo. But no fear, friend. I've made up the difference. Any enterprising man must. Would you like to know how?
Would this involve our independent thief?
Antonin stood, ignoring him, and gestured to a set of rickety wooden stalls in the back, with drapes drawn across their entrances.
Come with me, sir. Yes, yes, come on.
Gregor grudgingly obliged, following him.
Tough economy these days,
said Antonin.
Tough market. That's what the campos talk about all day long. Market conditions. We all play the same game. One opportunity dries up, so one must look for another.
He walked over to one stall, grabbed a drape, and pulled it open. Gregor looked inside. The stall was dark, but he could see a pallet on the floor and a single burning candle. At the far back was a boy, wearing a short tunic, legs and feet bared. The boy stood when the drape opened. He was maybe 13. Maybe. Gregor looked at the soft pallet on the floor, and then at the boy. Then he understood.
You take away my waterfront work,
said Antonin merrily,
so I expand my enterprise into a new market. But this market is so much more profitable than the waterfront. High margins, low capital.
I just needed the nudge to give it a go.
He stepped closer to Gregor. The scent of his rotting teeth was overwhelming.
So, Captain Dandolo, I don't need a single devat of your damned money.
Gregor turned to look at Antonin, his fists trembling.
Welcome back to Tavan,
said Antonin.
The only law in the commons is might and success. Those who win are the ones who make the rules. Perhaps an elite child such as yourself forgot.
He grinned, his greasy teeth glimmering.
Now, get the hell out of my taverna.
Gregor Dandolo walked out of the Perch and Lark in a daze. He retrieved whip from the toothless thug at the door, ignoring the other guards as they cackled at him.
Fruitful meeting? Asked the toothless heavy. Did he give you a handful of minch in the stalls? Was there any pull left when you pushed?
Gregor walked away without a word, buckling whip back to his belt. He walked a bit down the alley and stopped. He thought for a moment. He took a breath and thought some more. Gregor Dandolo did his utmost to follow the laws, both the laws of the city and his own moral laws of the universe. But more and more these days, one seemed to disagree with the other. He took off his water watch sash, folded it up and carefully placed it on a nearby windowsill. Then he took whip off his belt and began the process of securely buckling its many leather straps to his forearm. Then he turned and marched back toward the taverna. The toothless heavy saw him coming and squared himself. Then he caught out a laugh and whooped.
Look here, lodge! We've got one who thinks she can—
But he never finished his sentence. Because then Gregor used whip. Gregor had made sure that when he'd had whip commissioned, all of its sigils were carefully concealed, so no one who looked at it would know it was altered in any way. With the sole exception of the straps for buckling it to your wrist, it mostly looked like an ordinary truncheon, with a shaft of about 3.5 feet and a ridged 4-pound steel head at the end. But in truth, it was much more than that. For when Gregor pressed a button on whip and snapped it forward, the 4-pound head would detach and fly forward, connected to the shaft of the truncheon by a thin but strong metal cable. The truncheon's head had been scribed to believe that, when it was detached from the shaft, it was actually falling straight down toward the earth, and so was simply obeying gravity, unaware that it was actually flying in whatever direction Gregor had tossed it. It would smash into anything in its path before Gregor clicked a small lever on the side of Whip's handle. At which point, Whip's head would remember how gravity actually worked. The cable would start rapidly retracting, and the head would come zipping back to the shaft with tremendous speed. This is what Gregor did as he approached the taverna.